Good day. All sites are now on the conference line in a listen-only mode. I'd like to turn the call over to your speaker today, Ms. Joyce Hirst. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thanks, Patrick, and welcome, everyone. This is a fourth call in our series on enhancing services in natural environments. The calls are sponsored by our OSEP Community of Practice on Part C settings in natural environments. Our settings community is facilitated by the National Early Childhood TA Center and the Southeast Regional Resource Center. The team of facilitators includes Linda Pletcher here at NECTAC and Liz Jackson at CERC, and they're really working hard on these calls. Other team members are myself at NECTAC, Delia Serpa at CERC, and Tal Black and Sharon Ringwall at NECTAC. And the tech support at both NECTAC and CERC have been really helpful in making these web-based phone calls happen. Linda, have I forgotten anything?
I think that's pretty well it.
Okay, well then will you introduce Dave and Melissa?
It's my privilege to introduce Dr. Melissa Shelton and Dathan Rush. I'll start with Melissa first. She is currently the director of the Family, Infant, and Preschool Program in Morganton, North Carolina. Beautiful place up in the mountains. Her experience and background prior to coming to North Carolina, her degrees are from the University of Oklahoma in special education and in physical therapy. She was the assistant professor at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center and has served as a consultant to Oklahoma's Sooner Start Early Intervention Program from 1990 to 2002. She's also served as a regional director for the Region 7 section of Pediatrics American Physical Therapy Association. She's co-authored several articles related to early intervention teamwork and several book chapters. Most recently, she is the co-author of a brand new text that's been out, published in this year, Coaching Families and Colleagues in Early Childhood Intervention. She's presented nationally on topics related to motor learning, transition, inclusion, evaluation and assessment, primary service providers as coaches, and the provision of services in natural environments. Dathan also has his degrees from Oklahoma, but from Oklahoma State University and Central State University. His background is in speech-language pathology, special education, speech, and hearing. He is currently the associate director at the Family, Infant, and Preschool Program in Morganton, North Carolina. Past experiences have included clinical assistant professor, personnel development consultant at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, assistant director of the Oklahoma Sooner Start Early Intervention Program. He's been an editorial board member of Infants and Young Children and also has published articles and chapters and books, and he is the other co-author of Coaching Families and Colleagues in Early Childhood Intervention that was just published. He's presented numerous workshops statewide and nationally on topics related to team building, primary service providers as coach, training of trainers, coaching, provision of services in natural environment. Together, Dathan and Melissa have provided ongoing consultation to a number of states and local early intervention programs, assisting administrators and practitioners in how to provide supports for families in natural settings. So they're bringing a wealth of experience to us today, and we're very pleased to have them leading the calls. So Dathan, Melissa, it's all yours.
Thanks, Linda. We appreciate that. We're really excited to have this opportunity, and we appreciate everyone joining us today. As Joycey mentioned, we are going to take some time to share some information, and then we really hope that you have some questions for us, because we always learn when we have that opportunity. So we look forward to your questions in a little while. Why don't we go ahead and move to the second slide, where we start talking about some of the key terms. And in the discussion today, we thought that it might be helpful to kind of tie in, for those of you who have participated in some of the other calls, where the information we're sharing fits with what you've already heard. And then certainly for those of you who haven't been involved, we've got the definitions available for you. So in the discussion of supporting families in natural learning environments, we identified just a few key terms, and two of them you can see there, activity settings and natural learning opportunities, have already been defined. If you attended and participated in the call with Mary Beth, Mary Beth Bruder, the first call, we absolutely use her exact definitions of activity settings and natural learning opportunities. So you've already seen those slides. For those of you who haven't, activity settings are simply situation-specific experiences, opportunities, or events that involve a child's interaction with people, the environment, or both. And it's all contextualized for the child to learn, and particularly focusing on participation in those settings and thinking about what the child's strengths and interests are within those settings. And natural learning opportunities are just specifically all of those contexts in which children can express competence and have the opportunity to learn. And again, those are precisely the definitions that Mary Beth Bruder uses. Carl Dunst, who is our colleague here at the Family Infant and Preschool Program, worked with Mary Beth on those national studies, and we use those definitions in our daily work here with families at FIP, which is the Family Infant and Preschool Program. The third definition there is the current operational definition of coaching, and for those of you who may not have the slide, I'll just read it to you. It's an interactive process of reflection and feedback used to provide support and encouragement, refine existing practices, develop new skills, and promote continuous self-assessment and learning. And we are going to talk specifically about coaching in just a little while. As you move through to slide three, another topic that Jason and I spend quite a lot of time talking about is the primary coach approach. Some of you may be more familiar with it as a primary service provider as coach. Dathan's getting ready to explain to you here in a minute why we're moving to using the terminology primary coach. And for those of you who don't have the slide, the definition is a team approach to supporting care providers. And Dathan and I use the term care providers to encompass all of the adults, basically, or young adults who are in the life of the child that we're supporting. So that's parents, grandparents, friends and neighbors, babysitters, child care providers, preschool teachers, early Head Start providers, so that we just use that term to kind of cut it short. But a team approach to supporting all the care providers, in which one team member is selected as the primary coach and focuses on coaching the identified learners as the primary intervention strategy to implement jointly developed, functional, discipline-free IFSP or IEP outcomes to promote increased child learning and participation in real-life activities with ongoing coaching and support from other team members. So more simply, it is the way we operationalize a transdisciplinary approach. So we're stipulating the types of strategies used by the team as we identify what the terminology primary coach.
As we move to slide four, we're going to start talking about the key principles and some of the supporting research behind the approach that we're going to be discussing during the next few minutes. The purpose of early intervention is listed there on slide four, and since you don't have the slides, many of you may not have the slides in front of you, let me define the purpose of early intervention. As Mary Beth Bruder spoke of in her presentation, the first in this series, she talked about the role of practitioners or early interventionists in Part C having three components, three roles really, that of assessment, consultation, and training. So when we look then at the purpose of early intervention, it's to support the care providers in developing both the competence and the confidence to help the child learn. And this is really a shift in our thinking of who really is our learner as early intervention practitioners. Who really is our learner? And it shifts from the child being our primary learner, which was the way most of us were trained, to the parent or the care provider the child care provider being the primary learner now in the early intervention program. As we look at slide number 5, we want to draw a distinction between the traditional paradigm that most of us were trained in and have practiced in for quite some time to the newer paradigm. This comes from the work of Carl Dunst. Back in 1986, he wrote an article called Rethinking Early Intervention, in which he looked at the federal legislation and the intent behind that legislation, as well as the research that was current at that time in terms of how do we provide support to young children and their families. In 2000, he rewrote that article to include updated research and entitled it Revisiting Rethinking Early Intervention. It's one of the top reads that we've listed on the next to the, or the last few slides in the presentation packet. So you can access those, the full references there in your slides. But what Carl was talking about was, first of all, a traditional paradigm that most of us have worked in. And there are 5 different models within that traditional paradigm. So I'm going to walk you through each of the 5 traditional models, and then we're going to take a look at and compare those to the newer paradigm for parent and child support. Within the traditional paradigm, our first model that we operated in was a treatment model. So in that model, we really focused on remediation of a disorder or a problem and its consequence that we generally identified based on family concerns, but also based on the evaluation and the tests that we used to administer to the child. And then our intent was to try to remediate the identified problems, delays, or disorders. We also traditionally operated in an expertise-based model, where we really depended, or had the family depend on, the professional expertise to solve the problem of the child, or the problems of the family. And there are several problems that are inherent with using an expertise-based model. One, it fosters dependence on the practitioners, which we certainly wanted to try to avoid. It really depends on the professional expertise rather than all the expertise, the knowledge that the parents have of their child. And the primary focus of the expertise-based model is to solve problems rather than really look at what is the family already doing that has promotional and development-enhancing qualities. The third model within the traditional paradigm was deficit-based, where we really focused on correcting the person's weakness or the deficits that we identified from our testing. Fourth model in the traditional paradigm was the service-based model. And in that model, we really looked at our practices mainly in terms of professional services that we had to offer. And this was really more of a scarcity-based type of a model where because the belief was that we had so few people in certain disciplines, that we really had to reserve those disciplines and that knowledge for the children with the most severe or significant deficits. So oftentimes, other children couldn't really access some of the knowledge and information that some of the providers might have to offer. And then finally, in the traditional paradigm, we had professionally-centered models, where the professional was really viewed as the expert who identify the recommendations and the needs for the person, as opposed to really focusing on the other person's perspective. If we switch now to slide 6, we see the models within the new paradigm. And we this is based on what we know now about child learning, about learning support, about participatory health giving. A number of different articles and studies went into the development of the new paradigm and the 5 different models that are within that. So rather than working in a treatment model, in the new paradigm, we would work in a promotion model, where we'd really focus on promoting competence and positive functioning on the part of the family and on the part of the child. So we look at how can we support what's already happening, or how can we support the types of activities and things that the family wants to do with their child or wants to have their child be able to do for himself or herself. Rather than an expertise-based model, we operate in a capacity-building model. So we're really focused on how can we build the capacity of those individuals who are around and support the child during most of their waking hours. Because as we all know, there's no way that we can be there enough. if it totally relies on us as early intervention practitioners to make changes come about on the part of the child. So we really have to rely on and support the families, child care providers, grandmas and grandpas, other people who are important in the child and family's life, to identify and be able to promote those opportunities, learning opportunities that have development and enhancing qualities. The difference between the deficit-based model, the model in the new paradigm, is the strengths-based model, where we look at and acknowledge the assets and the strengths of the family and the child, and we really build upon those. As opposed to the service-based model, in the new paradigm, we have a resource-based model. And we come to realize that the formal early intervention system is only one formal resource of a really broad range of both formal and informal resources that the family may have accessible to them. So early intervention services and programs are a formal resource. Physicians, hospitals, health department programs, school-based programs are all formal resources that families may be able to access. And then families have a wide variety of informal resources, from their own extended family members to neighbors, friends, and associates, to churches if they participate in a faith-based community, and so forth. And so we want to identify what are all the possible resources that families can access to support the child's growth and development. And then finally, moving from a professionally centered model in the traditional paradigm to a family-centered model in the new paradigm, we really view the professionals and the practitioners as agents of the family who are responsive to their desires and priorities and who are there to share information in a way that families can make informed decisions.
The information that Dathan just shared with you is absolutely critical to your further understanding of the rest of the presentation today, because we experience a good amount of time of the time that if you are functioning in more of a traditional paradigm, some of the topics that we will bring up later are cause conflict. And so if you start feeling that way, one, mark your question so we can talk about it at the end of the presentation, but also go back in your mind to what the traditional paradigm looks like and what the newer paradigm looks like, because as we move to slide number 7, with our strategy, as we're focusing on a primary coach who is using coaching to build the capacity of the care providers for enhancing participation to promote child learning across activity settings, family activity settings, community activity settings, and early childhood settings, it's essential that you're functioning in the new paradigm, because it won't work. And we have data to show that it won't work in a traditional paradigm. Let's move to slide 8, and we're focusing again on how children learn, and the data we have from many, many sources and many, many fields to tell us how children learn. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The definition that is on this slide is one that Dathan and I first introduced in the article we wrote a few years back on the 10 myths about providing support in a natural environment. And then we just expanded on that in a recent article with Barbara Hance on coaching. And we define looking at learning, and our role in supporting that learning is promoting the child's ability to be and do by facilitating the family's or care provider's ability to enhance the child's development using what they, and they being the family and the child, consider important. And for the child, this means being with the partners in life who the child wants and needs to be with, and doing what he wants and needs to do. So we'll give you some specific discussions in just a little bit about what that looks like. Just building upon how children learn, if you move to slide 9, we just have some bulleted points there for, and the first one being natural learning opportunities, as we defined when we started the discussion. And this, in along with the new paradigm, is a key factor in supporting families in natural settings, because the natural learning opportunities are the vehicle for the support that we provide. So it's very different than in a clinic-based setting, or Dathan often talks about and has written about kerplunking intervention, and that sort of means taking what you would have done in your therapy room or in your classroom and taking that out and kerplunking it in the family's living room or kerplunking it out in their backyard, but using those natural learning opportunities as a way to support families in enhancing their child's ability to be successful. So the playtime out in the backyard is the natural learning opportunity if that's what the family and child are interested in. So we don't go in and then in that playtime in the backyard set up some therapeutic activity, but instead coach the parents on how the child can participate more successfully during that time, or even challenge the child in that setting in lots of different ways to enhance the child's play or communication with other children, climbing a tree, you name it, what the possibilities could be. Participation in existing and desired activity settings is the second bullet there, and this was one of those big ahas for us as we were, as we've been on this journey, that the focus of what we're doing and the outcome, what we're working toward and supporting the families and moving towards, is maximizing the child's participation, not focusing on a specific skill. And we, again, are gathering quite a bit of data to tell us that focusing on skills, originally from the work of Carl and Mary Beth, limits learning opportunities for children. But as we look to participating in natural opportunities, natural learning opportunities, that's when learning is maximized. So that's something very important as well. Child and family interests and assets. We're pretty much saying the days are gone where we're bribing children to do so many of these or so many of those, and then they get to choose the toy they want to play with, or I'll admit in front of everyone, bribing with M&Ms or bribing with a favorite activity, that we're talking about that being gone. It becomes a moot point because what you're doing is following the child's lead or the family's lead in terms of things that they want the child to be able to do within the context of either family life or community life or in a childcare setting, early childhood life. And the last point there is planned and spontaneous activities. And many of you, we're sure, are already engaged in supporting families in planned learning opportunities with their children. Very much remember when I got the aha about embedding therapy into real life. And we're not talking here about embedding therapy into life. We're talking about taking and looking and observing and being in real life and supporting the family's ability in maximizing their child's success in that life. Not sticking in, oh, why you change the diaper, do three of these or four of these, but thinking about what the child is doing and promoting that child's ability during what is already existing. So we know the planned piece is probably there, but there is a lot of fun and exciting learning in spontaneous moments. And as we're finding, a lot of those spontaneous moments are child-initiated activities, which we need to make sure that we're engaging families and supporting the children in that.
So at this point, a few of you may be thinking, especially if you have a tendency or have been operating in more of a traditional paradigm, you may be thinking, well, then what is my role? What is it that I'm going to do when I go to the family's home or I go to the child care facility? Where do I start? We looked across the literature to find, well, what are some others in the field, the discipline fields as well as the field of early intervention, what are they saying about what the role of the provider, the practitioner is? Suzanne Campbell, in an article that she wrote a number of years ago, suggested that our role really is more of a coach rather than a hands-on provider. Barbara Camp, who is an occupational therapist, a colleague of ours, and the co-author with us on the recent book, she too suggested in an article a few years ago that our role is that of a coach, to come alongside the parents as a coach rather than a key player. Lori Dinnabile, who is in the field of early childhood special education and very active in the Division of Early Childhood at the Council for Sectional Children, in fact, on the executive committee, and is a faculty member in Ohio. She has done a number of different studies and has been working for a number of years to support early childhood special educators as coaches to early childhood education teachers. And then Kathy Sofel, several years back, wrote an article about collaborative consultation in speech-language pathology, where she was talking about really the role of the speech-language pathologist to support the care providers who are the true facilitator of change in the child. So what it comes down to, and what our literature is saying, and certainly we agree with, is that our role as early intervention practitioners is that of a coach. And we engage in the process of coaching, which, as you can see on slide 10, if you have the handouts there, is an interactive process of both observation and reflection in which the coach promotes the other person's ability to support the child in being and doing. Being and doing, like Melissa defined a few minutes ago. So let's transition now to look at how does this all fit with the IFSP, the Individualized Family Service Plan process, and what are some of the key practices that we need to be aware of. And so we're going to start at the very first meeting. So what does that look like when you're really focusing more on activity settings, child and family interests, rather than discrete skills or deficits and things that the child is not able to do? Well, from the get-go, from the initial meeting, our focus is really gathering information from the family about the family. So we start by asking them to tell us about their family and the types of things that they do together, how they spend time, what they enjoy doing together. We ask them to tell us about the child, what the child is good at doing, what the child likes to do. We ask them to tell us about some of the things that they just have to do as part of being a family, like going to the grocery store or going to the big discount store that will remain nameless that we all end up at some point or another during the month, if not more frequently. And then we ask them about their activities, but then also about their interests. And so if you look on slide 12, it lists the steps for involvement in learning opportunities. And so we identify what the child is interested in, the fun things that the child enjoys doing, or the mundane or the routine family activities that the child participates in. We ask them to identify both the family and the community activities that relate to the child's interest and the child's age in which they participate, or in which maybe another sibling in the family participates, but the child who happens to be within the early intervention program participates. And we ask them to start thinking about how they already involve or how they could involve the child in other activities that are of interest to them that would support and promote child competence. So our role really is to join with the family to figure out or to agree with some of the strategies that they're already doing, that they could be doing, and that they would like to do, that would naturally support the child's participation in those activity settings that could have development-enhancing qualities for the child.
And let me just mention, for those of you who don't have the slides, I neglected earlier and on the last slide that some more work from Carl Dunst. It's a Dunst, Herter, and Shields article that's in your references. And then also a lot of this work is from the collaboration between Carl and Mary Beth and the work of Carol Trivett, Debbie Hamby, Tracy Humphreys, Melinda Robb. So just so you all know that, I'm not reading the references on the slide, but I don't want to shortchange where all this great work has come from. I'm moving now to slide 13, and this, for those of you who don't have the slides, this is a diagram of some work by some other colleagues here at the Family, Infant, and Preschool Program. Don Mott, Linda Wilson, and Deb Batman. And it's a model for looking at assessment that is around family interest, child interest, that is strengths-based and is in natural learning environments. So let's just go ahead and move to slide 14, and it gives you a little sample there of the tool that is now being piloted. Actually, a journal article has been accepted for topics in early childhood special education on the pilot information, and actually has the tool that will be published soon. And it's called the Asset-Based Context Matrix. And the purpose of the, we call it for short, the ABC Matrix. The purpose of the ABC Matrix is really a process for capturing all of the information that Dathan was just talking about in the back two slides, about how we identify activity settings, how those interests are a part of the activity settings, and it helps us organize where our supports are needed in maximizing the family's ability to continue to do all the great things that they're already doing, and then identify some areas where they may need some additional support. The writing on my printout is kind of slide here as I'm making my way into the mid-40s, and the side has, it's a grid with a matrix that has activity settings, child and family interests, child and family assets, functional and meaningful interactions, current opportunities, current participation, and then possibilities. And then across the top of the matrix is the context of family life, community life, and early childhood programs. So the notion is, it's really just a matrix. Dathan and I often call it, it's a containment document for capturing all that information that really comes very naturally from just asking the family a few questions about what they're already doing and what their interests are. And you will see, if you go ahead and look to slide 15, this is really leading you into the evaluation and assessment process that's required as a part of Part C of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And we, and if you look back at the matrix, the notion of what's currently happening, so those are present levels, what the child is currently doing, and then possibilities is a great place to capture the information that would eventually become the outcomes on the IFST. So if you look to evaluation and then you think back to the traditional paradigm, if we were all sitting in a room together, Dathan and I would ask you to tell us, how does evaluation fit into a strengths-based model? And the answer is, it really doesn't, because it's one of the steps that we have to go through in the process to determine eligibility. And that's why we, again, are quoting the definitions from the law that separate evaluation and assessment into two different processes. And we feel that's very important. Evaluation is determined to determine eligibility. And then assessment is all of the other stuff that we do to identify what the family is interested in, why they're calling us, and what support we can identify or help them to identify that will match what they're looking for. And so that assessment is what we use to gather the information that is going to be pulled together to write the IFST. So if you look to slide 16 and think about the IFST, we could spend an entire day talking about the IFST and how that document has kind of changed and morphed over the years to become lots of different things. But the initial idea of the IFST was documenting those supports and those identifying those outcomes that we hope to achieve. And so on this slide, as we talk about IFST development, Dathan and I are really focusing and working with people in lots of different states on identifying participation-based outcomes. So the outcomes are more about real-life kinds of activities. They're not about sitting or walking or putting two words together or going to the bathroom in the right spot or keeping your teeth to yourself. It's really about real-life kind of stuff that families are engaged in on a regular basis, so the child has enough opportunity to actually learn some new skills or get better at some existing skills. So just some hints there, we've identified you can't write participation-based outcomes that are discipline-specific. So that means no OT, PT, speech, education, no nursing goals. They're the child's or the family's outcomes, and they're written around real-life stuff. As I mentioned, they're not skill-based, so they don't identify, you know, Stacy will, and then there's a skill there. So it's not Stacy will walk or Stacy will say or Stacy will sit. We've got some examples later in the presentation that you'll see what more specifically what we're talking about. A good outcome crosses developmental domains. So that's a quick question you can ask yourself. If it is specific to motor domains, then it's not probably, most likely, not a good participation-based outcome. The participation-based outcomes are also functional and meaningful to the child and family, and they're measurable according to the family. We've encountered, as of late, in lots of different situations that, again, in a more traditional model, looking at a expertise-driven or professionally-centered model, that the practitioners feel like they're the ones who say when the child has met the outcome or when the family has met the outcome. And it's very clear that families are supposed to be driving that process and determining if that's something that they feel has been met or if they're even still interested in continuing to focus on that. And then the last little tip there is something that we used at the University of Oklahoma a lot in writing outcomes, and it's just a little reminder for yourself, that third word rule. That third word, so Stacy will, and then fill in the blank, is, you know, play with her brothers and sisters, go to church with her family, eat, participate in family meals. Those are meaningful things, not a specific skill. So that's just another way to kind of check yourself on those types of outcomes. So the bottom line in all of that is that when you're using the new paradigm and this type of approach, the way IFSTs typically look, most typically, not always, but most typically look, does not fit with this kind of approach because, as we know, research is telling us focusing on skills limits learning opportunities, and we're in the business of enhancing learning opportunities, not limiting them.
In 2001, Dunst, Trivett, Humphreys, Robin, Roper wrote an article in Infants and Young Children, the journal Infants and Young Children, that is entitled Contrasting Approaches to Natural Learning Environment Interventions. And again, when you can access the slides, this is another one of the articles on the must-read list. And they really ask three questions that we believe are excellent ways for us to think about our practices and the how do we do what it is that we do when we're in the natural learning context. And one question that they ask is what you are supporting the parent in doing contextualized or is it decontextualized? And what that means is it happening within the context of real life activities so that it's meaningful and functional and the meanings in terms of why you're doing what it is that you're doing are inherent within the activity? Or are they decontextualized, where we've pulled a skill or an activity really out of context and we're having a child do it over and over again for practice, but the meaning is not inherent within the task. So in a decontextualized approach, the skill that we're working on is really the end result rather than in a contextualized, the skill is a means to an end. For example, as a speech pathologist, you know, I can't tell you the number of times that I pulled out my language cards of different food items, and I would have the child name the item on the card. That would be decontextualized. To make that more contextualized, as I'm working with families in their natural environment, then we may, at mealtime or at snack time, talk about the different types of foods that they're eating or have the child make some type of request for a specific type of food item that they want. That would be contextualized and it would be functional within an everyday activity. The second question that they ask is what you're doing to support the parent in doing, is it child-initiated or is it adult-directed? And oftentimes we fall into the adult-directed side where we've really, we've come up with the ideas and the activities that we're going to have the child do, as Melissa alluded to earlier, rather than following the child's lead and really showing interest in joining the child in activities in which they're actively engaged and they're working to master based on what their interests are. And what we know from child learning literature is that there needs to be a balance of these. There needs to be a balance of some child initiated, and then there are, in real life, activities that have to be adult directed. Most children don't really like to brush their teeth. Some children don't want to engage in a bedtime routine and go to bed at night. So there need to be some adult-directed types of activities. The third question that they ask is what you are doing, supporting the parent in doing, dependent on you being there, you being the early intervention practitioner, and you being there or not? And if we're really focused on doing things to the child or trying to teach the parent to do things or not teaching the parent to do some things because only we have the skill and the knowledge to do it, we really need to question ourselves about that. Because if we really want it to make a difference in the life of the child and want there to be opportunities for that to be done and to happen over and over throughout the course of the child's day, then we really need to be focusing on those things that happen and can happen when we're not there. And that's how we should be spending our energy and our time when we're with the family. On slide 18.
You want to talk about toy bags.
Oh, yes. toy bag therapy. Our colleague Julianne Wood, on her website, her fastest website, has the 10-step program for decreasing toy bag dependency, which we love because if you wag a bag, as I did for many years when I first started working in early intervention, that's really decontextualized. Even if you bring toys that the child's interested in and you unpack them out of your bag and you therapize the child or you engage the child around those toys, it's really decontextualized because they're not toys that are the child's own. Typically, they're not toys that we're going to leave with the child. Sometimes people jump to, well, the child doesn't have any toys. Well, then what does the child do? What does the family do? What does the child play with or engage around when you're not there? That's what we really need to be focusing on. What are the activity settings and the learning opportunities that are occurring when we're not there? So slide 18 talks about, again, coaching as the strategy for us as early intervention practitioners. And we use coaching to develop the competence and confidence in the care providers to implement strategies that then are going to increase the child's learning opportunities and participation in daily life. Coaching is also going to help them to identify when are those strategies that they're doing working or not, how can they adapt the strategy, and how can they adapt some of these things that they're doing to work with other people in other situations at other times. So if you look on slide 19, if you have it there in front of you, our goal then as a coach really is sustained excellent performance on the part of the learner in which they have confidence if it doesn't work, and then they're generalizing the strategies that they're trying and their ideas to support the child's development to other situations that they do.
And just to add a little bit to that, if you look to slide 20, from some of the work of Carol Trivett and Carl Dunst in 99 about participatory help giving, and there are some bullets there that are identified as key indicators of participatory help giving strategies. And coaching is an effective help giving strategy. And some of the types of intervention, personally, I know that I engaged in when I first started working in early intervention, were not effective help giving strategies. Telling people what to do and having them become dependent upon you to guide what their interactions are with their children is not a capacity-building approach. So there are two pieces to help giving, a relational piece and a participatory piece. The relational piece is all of that information, and we again, the research that we had to talk about the type of characteristics of the help giver. You need to be caring and honest and nice and empathetic and all of those things that families have said over and over again that they look for in a helpful practitioner. The participatory piece is a piece where the real action and learning occurs. This is not just fluffy talking about, oh, isn't everything going great, but really getting in there and supporting families in developing new skills or enhancing skills that they already have. So The bullets there are the help giver interpersonal skills, which I mentioned, attitudes about help receiver competence, which takes us back to a strengths-based approach, that we see the positives in what people bring, not the just the negatives, and certainly we don't focus on that. The help receiver's ability to make choices and act upon those choices, and then our responsiveness and flexibility to what it is they are seeking from us.
Now we want to talk just briefly about the coaching process. And again, on the slides in terms of the reading materials at the end of this presentation, we've listed some an article as well as the book if you're interested in delving into more information about coaching. But it's basically a process that involves five components. It is not a linear process. It's a very fluid process that, I mean, you can start at multiple points, but basically it involves initiation. We're going to initiate a coaching relationship or coaching reaction with another person. Coaching can be used both with families as well as with colleagues. The second component is that of observation, where we're going to observe the learner, who could be the colleague or the care provider, doing what it is that they're doing, and then we're going to reflect on that, and then we could provide them with feedback about what it is that was observed. Or it could be a modeling situation where I, as the early intervention practitioner, am going to model something for the parent or the care provider using the child, and then we're going to reflect on that and talk about that, have the parent maybe practice that or try it, which would move us to the action practice component, where the learner is actually engaged in active participation related to whatever the skill or the piece of knowledge is that we're working on and that we've been talking about. So they have opportunity to practice both while we're there during the visit, but more importantly, they practice it while we're not there, and they use some of the strategies that we've talked about. The most important component in the coaching process is the reflection component. This is what differentiates coaching from strictly mentoring or consultation or collaborative consultation. It's where we're really asking the learner to reflect on what it is that they have done. Why they did that, did they get the results that they intended, what was their intent to begin with, what might they do differently, what are some different ways for engaging the child or doing something with the child or participating with the child in the context of a learning opportunity, and then what are they going to do as a result of the conversation. It's also during reflection where we may provide feedback based on our observations or based on some information that the parent is giving us, but only as it follows reflection. And then finally, there's a component in the coaching model of evaluating the entire coaching process to determine how effective is this with the learner, with the parent, the family member, the care provider. Are they getting to and achieving the outcomes that they've identified on the IFSP? And then we can make a decision of, do we need to continue our coaching conversations, or are is the question or the issue or the priority that we've been focusing on really resolved? And then do we move to another priority or idea, question of the family or the colleague, or do we resolve the coaching interaction, the coaching relationship? On slide 22, there's a model of the coaching process. I won't go into that because of time, but also because most of you don't have that in front of you, and so it would be rather difficult to try to explain the diagram at that point, but it really shows how it's more of a interactive process rather than just a linear series of steps that you would move through. When you're using a coaching approach and you're focused on promoting the parent capacity to support the child's learning in the context of activity settings, it really makes sense that there be a primary person who's there serving as the coach. Now, is it possible to have multiple people coaching the family? Sure, that's possible. Does it make sense over the long term? No. It doesn't make sense to the family, and typically it doesn't make sense to the different practitioners, because we know from some research that's been done as well as research that we're currently conducting here at the Family Infant Preschool Program that the fewer people that you have involved, the higher the likelihood that the parents are going to find the support being helpful. So that brings us to the use of a primary coach model for supporting families within the context of early childhood intervention. And on slide 23, we define that by saying that the primary coach model is used when the program's identified as a formal resource for early childhood intervention and has multiple staff with diverse knowledge and experiences from which to choose to support the care providers. So as you're implementing, as Melissa said, those jointly developed, discipline-free outcomes that focus on child assets, they focus on child interests, we're really working on capacity building and supporting the parents and the care providers. When we're truly operationalizing the new evidence-based model, then it makes sense to go towards a primary coach approach for supporting the family, who then in turn are going to be supporting this and promoting the child's development and learning. A common question that we get at this point is, well, how do you select who the primary coach is going to be? What would make the most sense? Well, if you're moving towards primary coach, and you can look at it on a continuum. And on one end of the continuum, you have, where if you're still operating more in a deficit-based, expertise-based model, but you're wanting to try to operationalize the primary coach approach, then you can pick the primary coach based upon the IFSP outcomes that are listed. You can look at what relationship does the primary coach have with the learner. Is there any pre-existing relationship? What are the knowledge, skills, and what's the information that the coach has that might be helpful or beneficial to the parent or care providers? And then in reality, we have to look at logistically, what's the availability of the person who might be the best coach for this family. If you're operating on one end of the continuum, then oftentimes teams will start by selecting the person who's most closely, the discipline most closely associated with the priorities of the family. As you then work more closely together as a team and come to know each other's strengths, challenges, what you know, how you support families, then we see that teams select the primary coach based on individual. So who's the best person on our team that's just the best match to support this family? And then finally, as you're looking at the far end of the continuum and you have a team that's worked together for a considerable amount of time and they know their strengths, they know when to pull somebody else in from the team for a joint visit, and they're all competent in terms of coaching, parent support, and child development, then there are situations where any member of the team could be a good primary coach for the family. But we're defining anyone on the team being the therapist, certified teacher, certified educator, would not include a paraprofessional or someone, obviously, who lacks the training or the credentials to appropriately provide the support to benefit the family and ultimately the child. So as we move to slide 25, we start listing the characteristics of the primary coach approach to be as clear as possible about what we mean by this approach. And the first characteristic is that you have one staff member or contract provider of the program that acts as the primary coach to the care providers and is selected, as I said, based on expertise in child development, family support, and coaching. The second characteristic of primary coach is that the primary coach has an awareness of and access to, and that's critical, program staff or contractors with a variety of knowledge, skills, and experiences. You must have access and have other disciplines on your team that can come in for a joint visit, that can consult with you and coach you around supporting this family as well. So you can't have a team that doesn't have a speech pathologist on it, or say, well, we used to have a speech pathologist and she taught me everything she knew before she left, so we can do primary coach. That's incorrect. You cannot. You've got to have access to a variety of disciplines. The third characteristic is that reciprocal coaching and learning occurs between the primary coach and the care providers, as well as between the primary coach and other program staff or contract providers. So there's ongoing communication, ongoing learning that's occurring across these people on that team and across that primary coach and the care providers. The next characteristic, which we're down to slide 27 now, is that the primary coach receives coaching from other program staff and contractors through ongoing interactions. And those ongoing interactions may include, as I said, joint visits that occur same place, same time, where the person who's coming with me, if I'm the primary coach, is coaching me how to support the family, but certainly the family's benefiting from that coaching as well. If you go to slide 28, when the visits occur at separate times, which they may need to have to because of time constraints and logistical issues, then the primary coach and the other team members have informed the family that the purpose of the visit is to gather additional information that's going to be shared with the primary coach for continued work with the family. On slide 29, we go on to further talk about that interaction, in that it's ongoing interaction, so it provides opportunities for reflection and information sharing in a continuous manner between team members, and the program staff members provide coaching to the primary coach, and it varies based on the needs or the desires of the primary coach for ideas and for timely feedback. But there must be a continual checking back and forth across team members to support the primary coach as the primary coach is supporting the family. So if you look on slide 30, we just list out what the primary coach approach is not, because as most of you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about the use of a primary coach approach and what some people think it means and others think it means. So it's not watered down. It's not a watered down approach, because the family has access to a full complement of disciplines on their team, and they can have a joint visit with those individuals whenever necessary. So we're not limiting access. In fact, for many families, we're increasing access and opportunities for interaction across team members. It is not teaching the care provider to do therapy. Pollock and Stewart, in a research study that they did, as well as Brotherson and Goldstein, have found that families do not want to be their child's therapist. They want to be the child's parent or the child's family members. So we work very hard to support the parents and the family members to support the child and promote the child's participation in the context of everyday activities, rather than having them do some kind of specific targeted skill-based therapeutic intervention. It is not a speech pathologist providing physical therapy. I'm a speech pathologist. I do speech-language pathology. I do speech therapy. I don't do physical therapy. I never will unless I go back and get a physical therapy degree and license. But there are things that I do and can do as a speech-language pathologist that are going to promote the child's learning and participation, such as positioning the child based on coaching by the physical therapist or maybe the occupational therapist on my team. I'm never going to, as a speech pathologist, construct or fabricate splints for a child. That would be out of my scope of practice. But I do know, based on my interactions and coaching from other team members, to identify warning signs of when a splint is being outgrown and when the physical therapist or the person with the skill to make the splint needs to come back in and take a look at that. We don't use a primary coach because we don't have a particular discipline available. That would not be good practice for us to go to this model, because we have too few people. And we don't use a primary coach approach to save money. And a lot of people accuse programs and systems of switching to a primary coach approach or model because they're trying to save money. And in fact, the jury's out on that. We do not have data to say that a primary coach approach is going to cost less than a multidisciplinary or an interdisciplinary approach. In fact, we're in the process of gathering data about that right now. Our hypothesis is it's about the same, and there are some studies that have been done that seem to corroborate that, but again, we're looking into that at this time, and we encourage programs and statewide systems not to make the decision to go to primary coach based on money, because that is yet unproven.
Jason and Melissa, you have about 5 more minutes for the presentation before we go to question and answer.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's move to slide 31, and some of you may be thinking, okay, wait, then what am I supposed to be doing? Jason talked to you about your role as a coach, but what do I do with my hands? This is what the next slide talks about. And for a while, I think Jason and I both remember the first time we said this out loud to a group and waited for tomatoes or worse to be thrown at us. But we've gotten this down to 2 reasons for hands-on types of interactions with children. And then there's a third one that has sort of been added. I'll tell you about that in a sec. One reason is assessment. You've got to figure out what's going on, and for many of us, that means we've got to get in there and try things, or be working with the parent to be trying things. The second reason is showing somebody else how to do something, modeling or teaching. The days of you going in because you're the only person who can get the child to do five of these or two of these, or you get the child to work the hardest, that does not fit with this model and does not fit with an evidence-based approach. And the third reason some of our colleagues have added too is to give the child a hug. That would certainly be another reason to lay those hands on. As we move to slide 32, when we're working with teams who are considering using a primary coach approach, we encourage them to think about two opportunities with families: those that are newly referred to the system, and then those families who currently are enrolled in the program. And they need to be treated differently. This is pretty much common sense, but the notion being with new families, how you explain what the program is about and what your approach is absolutely critical. With families who have been in an existing system where it's different than a primary coach, you need to have a very open and honest conversation about their interest and willingness in trying something new. And will probably involve going back and even doing additional assessment, because most IFSPs are skill-based, and we're talking about moving away from that to a participation-based IFSP.
And very quickly, on slide 33, some considerations if you're considering using a primary coach approach. You have to have administrative and physical financial support to be able to do this, so that you can have an identified team with multidisciplinary representation. You've got to know who to go to and who your other team members are for coaching. The team needs to meet on a regular basis, and you need to plan to meet more regularly and more frequently up front as you're just developing and learning how to operate in a primary coach approach. There need to be opportunities for joint visits of team members, and people need to get paid to do joint visits. We would never expect somebody to go do a joint visit and not get paid to do that. And there needs to be opportunities for ongoing coaching, as we said before, among and across team members.
If you look, we have slides 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, and 39, and 40. Those are slides that we put together as an example of what this would look like. So just for time's sake, I'm just going to explain to you quickly. This is a mother and a daughter that Dathan and I had the opportunity to work with many moons ago with a team in Oklahoma. And the first two slides just give you some information about the mother and daughter. And then this family moved to the state of Oklahoma from another state. And so you see in slide 36 the existing IFSP outcomes, which are skill-based. So the next slide tells about the previous service delivery. So you have sort of the existing situation there. On slide 38 and 39, you see a revised version with participation-based outcomes. Destiny will play with her favorite toys while seated in her high chair, infant walker, and standing frame by July 4th. Destiny will participate in mealtime by letting her mother know what bite of food she'd like by next Thanksgiving, and Destiny will gain 5 pounds over the next 6 months. The slide that follows that, slide 39, at the bottom of the page, gives you the current service delivery using, which reflects the primary coach approach. So in this situation, the team chose the occupational therapist as the primary coach, and you'll see probably for most of you a different way of framing the time. So we're talking about a two-week period. So if we were actually writing this on the IFSP, we would put from and write the date to the next date, which is 2 weeks apart, and we would describe the intervention there. And then the next 2 weeks, the next 2 months, and then the next 3 months. And all of those have the OT going as the primary coach, and then joint visits are occurring at the rate that you see identified there. Those visits are happening at the same place and same time, and are in both the home setting and the child care setting, mostly in the child care setting. And Then if you just go to the next slide where we just said add it up, I think when you, most people look at that service delivery statement, they say, my gosh, we would never go 7 hours in the first 2 weeks with an OT and 2 hours with a PT. That's 9 hours of service delivery in a two-week period. But if you look at the slide 40, with the previous setup, the way it had been in the other state, with people going there once a week or twice a week over a six-month period, it adds up to 108 hours of service delivery. And with a very intense approach using a primary coach, it's 44 visits over a six-month period. And so I think when you examine that, most people that we've interacted with think that it's a very intensive and certainly not watered-down type of approach with families. Joycey, I think we're ready to turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much. What's interesting is that our internet connection just came up and came through. Of course, at the very end of the presentation. But people can look at the slides later, and certainly they can download those that give references. There's a lot of helpful materials that you all might want to have for the duration. And these slides will be available along with the other call slides at this website for a while. Thank you. We are ready for questions.
Patrick?
Yes, ma'am. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone at this time. You may withdraw your question with the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone telephone at this time. We will pause 1 moment while we queue for questions. Okay, we'll take our first question from the site of Lynn Johnson from Birth to Three in Old Lyme, Connecticut. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Ms. Johnson, your line is open.
Hi, my name is Lynn Miner, and I'm a speech pathologist in Connecticut. I do see families. I saw one this morning where the child has toys that are broken or mangled or ripped. I don't see toys in that house, but a TV is on all the time, and I was wondering if you had suggestions for how to try to use coaching in a house where I see children who mostly are watching TV during the day and not really going out of the house with their family.
Okay. Lynn, one thing that we would, well, absolutely what we would start with is we would look at what are the activity settings in which the family participates. So what do they find important? And watching TV can be an activity setting. And we would ask about other activity settings, any kind of bedtime routines, bedtime activities, meals, how does that go, what does that look like, etc. And then our role then in coaching the family would be around supporting the child so that the child can participate within whatever types of routines and activities are occurring. And if there are opportunities for play and that's something that they value and that they spend time doing, then what is it that they are playing with that would naturally occur within the house, within the context? So that's where we would start.
Another, I think, thing to think about is are the parents watching television with the children? Whether it's a child show or not, that's really not the point, but are they there together? Because if they are there together, there are opportunities for interaction during that time. If the family is using the television as a time for them to do some other things or just kind of veg out because the child's connected with the TV, then that brings up some other discussions about the types of supports the family might be interested in and how they are meeting their own needs for their own time and their own interests and things that they like to do. It kind of gets to that, it gets down to the nitty-gritty of family-centered supports, and are those things that we think are the best for the child or that we as a practitioner would do ourselves? And the answer, kind of from the way you put it forth, is probably not. But again, we're in that family's environment to support that child within that setting. and promote the possibilities there. So us bringing in something that we know the child likes during the time that we're there isn't going to meet or make any differences in terms of the capacity of the family for the long haul. So we have to get over that notion of, but it's, you know, it's tough, or it's not there, or it's certainly not what I think is best for the child. But then really having some open coaching conversations with the family long term for what they're interested and willing to do.
Really quickly then, would you say that coaching works well with any family, or would you need a family who the parent is committed to helping their child develop?
Any family.
Absolutely any
works
family.
Works for everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take our next question from Toby Long at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
I don't have a question. I just need to say hi to Melissa.
Hey, stranger. How are you?
And how are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was great.
Thank you. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, we've got to talk someday.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone telephone at this time. We'll take our next question from Virginia Heifel of Prince William County Early Intervention at Manassas, Virginia. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm asking about slide 16 where you said you make your outcomes measurable according to the family. Are you saying that you don't use lingo that the insurance company is going to reimburse you for, or what's your recommendation there?
Okay, that is what we're saying, and that's kind of what I was alluding to, Virginia, about the IFSP is being used for lots of different things.
Right.
We certainly know some states that are using the IFSP as the billing document, and what they're running into some difficulty, exactly what you've described, because most participation, real-life kind of outcomes aren't readily approved by third-party payers or even Medicaid, because they're looking for the skill. And so we're maintaining and are working with several states who are using the IFSP as the promise and agreement with the family of what it is we're in there to support. And then if I'm in a system that requires me to bill based on measurable goals determined by that insurance company or Medicaid, then my plan of care reflects those kinds of outcomes. So one of Destiny's outcomes back there about participating in mealtime, that what I would do with that would be, if I were the OT, that I would write some more short-term skill-based goals that would be identifying what her behaviors would be and what we would see change over time as a result of my support. That makes sense?
So you're saying you could use the IFSP to meet both purposes. You could word it such that it's measurable to the family and it would satisfy the insurance company's needs.
That's right. And then I guess the tough part we're holding to is if it won't, we're not in support of modifying the IFSP to become only what I can get paid for, because we feel like we hold the IFSP in a different place.
Okay.
And we want that to stay where it is. But then in my plan of care that I submitted, that's where I would put the stuff that the payer is needing.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
We will take our next question from Tanya Otten, Statewide Parent Advocacy Network in Newark, New Jersey. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, it's actually Diana Otten. I am with the Parent Training Information Center in New Jersey, the Statewide Parent Advocacy Network. And I'm wondering two things. First, to what extent are you finding that families, by the time you see them, already have a completely different picture of what early intervention is supposed to be about, i.e., fixing their child? And do you have specific strategies that you use to help families understand the purpose of early intervention and what kinds of things can be more effective than that model?
That's an excellent question, and you bring up a great point in terms of how quickly our culture is in families getting those impressions with very, very, very young children, infants, very young children. And so the notion of all of a sudden, you know, this is going to be completely different than what they were expecting, with the networks that families have and the information that they many of them have access to, it's very common for someone to have already, another parent to have already contacted them to tell them, this is what my child has and all of these services that I've gotten. So it absolutely is something that when we're working with teens, we tell them to expect that and anticipate that. And again, the open and honest conversations about what it is that families are wanting to happen. And if I just give you an example of a family saying, well, but I want my child to walk. I want him to walk. I want him to walk. And right away, my questions are going to be, okay, I absolutely hear you saying you want your child to walk. Putting that right here, writing it down. Let's talk about all of the opportunities that you have during your day right now where walking would be a benefit to him. So what chances does he have throughout the day? What are the things he likes to do? Because we know if he's motivated to do those things, then we're more than likely going to be able to, that's where we have our greatest likelihood, is what I should say, of achieving the skill needed to participate in those kinds of activities. What we have found often is that when families are coming with, let's say, prescriptions for service delivery or definitely a different perception of what it's like, many times they don't have the specific information of what they expect to happen from those services being delivered, but just know that that's what someone has told them they needed or somebody else that they trust has told them to ask for that. And so if you can get them engaged in a conversation about what they're doing, what their interests are, what family life already offers in terms of learning opportunities, we are really having positive success with families being interested in doing this. One of the strategies we use is, there's a team in Nebraska that we've worked with quite a lot, and they've not had anybody not want to do this, but one of the things they do is talk about, okay, would you be willing to try this for such and such period, and it's a short time, 1 month, 2 months, 2 weeks, and then we'll get together and talk about what you're thinking about how it's going. And that's been a real successful strategy for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Joan Cooksey of Early Childhood Intervention in Austin, Texas. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Actually, our question's already been answered. It had to do with the third-party payers and the documentation for them. So we're good.
Okay, thanks.
We had no further questions at this time, ma'am.
Well, that's probably just as well because our time is just about up. So we thank Dathan and Melissa very much.